Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. Dr. Ray Kirk, federal benefits specialist with NITP and a former manager of benefit officers training and development and retirement services for the U.S. OPM. And we have Tammy Flanagan and myself, Bob Lyons, co-hosts of For Your Benefit. Well, good to hear you. And we're going to talk about financial literacy. So I'm going to start off really basic. What is financial literacy? I mean, if I don't know finances, what should I know to establish myself as knowing financial literacy, or be aware of it anyway?
Well, at its core, the financial literacy is understanding enough about financial matters that you can make informed decisions. So it's things like understanding your benefits and where they fit into your overall financial picture. So understanding the impact of paying interest on credit cards, impact of putting savings in TSP, and being able to put all those ideas together.
Tammy, in your world, you've made a significant name for yourself explaining the unexplainable about benefits. So in your world, when do you find people first start to be aware of their benefits, or should they be aware of their benefits?
Well, it's funny because, as you know, Bob, every time we do a seminar, whether it's pre-retirement, where people are one foot out the door, or whether it's a mid-career, we always get the comment at the end of the class, wish we would have had this earlier. So it seems like we can never get it out early enough to employees. So I think it really needs to start from day one, especially with a retirement system that's based on personal savings. If you don't understand that foundation of how to save for retirement and supplement your pension and your Social Security, it's going to be a lot harder to retire at a young age.
So starting mid to late career to provide that financial cushion, they would have earned some type of benefit, but they don't always understand the financial side. There has to be a pot of money somewhere. It doesn't have to be a pot of gold, but it's got to be some money to fall back on.
Well, it depends on how long you work. You might not need any money if you never retire, but if you want to retire in your 50s or early 60s, having some savings certainly is going to make it go a lot farther and make it a much more comfortable lifestyle.
Right. I agree with Tammy, and I think it's important for people to get started thinking about those issues as early as possible. As Tammy said, when we do the seminars, people always say, I wish I knew this or heard this information 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And it's somehow we need to get employees to start wanting to know that information earlier in their careers and not halfway through their career, when they can still accrue a fair amount of savings under the FERS system. But it's the earlier they get started, the better off they'll be.
Yeah, and the other thing I think we're noticing more today than ever before is we have employees who are either coming into federal service mid-career or leaving federal service before retirement. So I think employees also need to understand how these benefits accumulate across the horizon of both federal service and private sector, military time, and how to put that all together. And I think sometimes that just feels overwhelming for a lot of people because they don't know how those pieces are similar and yet distinctly different as well.
Right. And that was one of the goals of the Federal Employees Retirement System, to add that flexibility and some portability elements across coming into the federal sector halfway through your career or leaving during your career, so that at least some of the benefits package still translates into the non-federal jobs.
I also find in my world, people fully don't understand what they spend. In other words, you might have this nice benefit, and you may spend more than a nice benefit, or you may spend less than the benefit. If you spend less than the benefit in retirement, great, but they don't always understand how much I need to retire. In other words, I start with my expenses and I go, okay, this is something I can cut. This is something I can't cut. This is something I want to increase. And I have to come to some level, and then I'll understand better how my benefit package fits in with my desires.
But if right. And Bob, I think the other thing you've always said is that in your world of taxes, a lot of employees don't realize that pretty much all of your retirement benefits, with just a few exceptions, are going to be also subject to tax. So when you're doing your financial planning, do some tax planning as well.
Absolutely, and it is one of the major expenses. I won't say it's a major expense for everybody, but it's a major expense in retirement. We're probably talking, if we talk CSRS, the annuity is really the locomotive that drives the train, but it very small percentage of it's non-taxable, maybe 5 or 10%. So the rest is open to income taxes. It could take 20%, 25% of the take. Now, the FERS individual, and I use this in class, I call it a triple-decker sandwich for the IRS. You got the base FERS annuity that's primarily taxable. Social Security is probably 85% taxable at the federal level and probably not at the state. And the thrift, unless it's the Roth thrift, is going to be 100% taxable. And so you put those three together and go, okay, this is what I have to meet my living expenses. And if we catch that early enough and do it often, too, I mean, somebody pre-retirement, it's getting a little late to make up for that, but beginning career, a lot of times I think the younger folks don't want to hear about it. I got 30 years, I got 35 years, plenty of time.
Yeah. Right.
Mid-career, they go, uh-oh.
And you point out, it really is important to have a plan, that there's an annual survey that's done, the Retirement Confidence Survey, and it was just the 2015 version was just released, and less than half the people have ever tried to make any kind of estimate of what their retirement needs are going to be. And
I know, Ray, you know that there's a lot of resources for federal employees on their agency's website. Sometimes your payroll system has retirement calculators. The TSP certainly provides calculators for estimating retirement income. So I think for federal employees, it's fairly easy if they know where to go, right?
Right. It's fairly easy. It's just getting them to take that first step. And that's really an important thing for federal employees to keep in mind, that they have to make that first step, figure out how to get the estimate. And no matter how early in their career, they should get some kind of projection of what they're going to get as from their retirement benefits as a floor for their retirement income.
Right. Sometimes that's a wake-up call for them when they do see the estimate. And other times it's like, wow, do I really have this much money coming in? They don't even realize what the value of their benefits are. So either whether it's good news or bad news, it's good to get that baseline to see when I'm eligible to retire, here's the kind of income that's going to come every month for the rest of my life. Now what else do I need to make it a comfortable life? And that's where the savings comes in.
All right, I did a little homework before the show, and I just keyed in financial literacy. And out pop all these sites, and virtually every one of them was a listing of computer programs. Well, if I don't understand dollars and cents, the computer program isn't going to get me very far. So could I pretend to be financially illiterate? Although my wife might say, you don't need to pretend. And so I'm going to ask you all, if I'm looking at my benefits, what can I do to improve those benefits for me later on in life? That would be, I guess, my first question. Or better, my first question is, what is my benefit going to be? And then after I know what my benefit's going to be and I can do some reasonable projection, what can I do to enhance that? Help!
Okay. Well, let's start off with the definition of financial literacy. You know, what does that really mean? And according to Wikipedia, the source of all information, it means it's the ability to understand how money works in the world, you know, how we manage it, how we earn it, how we make it, how we invest it. And so when it comes to federal retirement planning, we're looking at the sources of income and how they work, whether it's your CSRS or FERS retirement, which is going to provide a lifetime source of income based on your length of service and your salary. So for federal employees who have made a career of federal service, that's going to be a major source of income. However, for those who have only worked in the government for 5 years or 10 or 15, then it's not going to be quite as important as maybe the savings part of it. Or for some employees, Social Security is a major source, because Social Security, the nice thing about it is that it's tilted to provide more replacement income for low-wage earners. So for someone who hasn't worked at a high salary, Social Security could be their major source of income, because it could replace for a low-wage earner up to 40%, maybe 50 or 60% of their pre-retirement income. So understanding that balance between savings, pensions, and Social Security, I think, is the key.
Tammy, I actually printed out the Wikipedia financial literacy yesterday. I promise you, Ray will confirm it. I have it here in front of me. I thought it was really good and talked about different countries, but we don't really need to talk about different countries.
No, we need to talk
on the
about
show. What we got.
Our federal workforce, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just very basic. You know, we're all our own financial planners. We know how much money we make. We know how we pay our bills. Sometimes, just like it is when we're all our own housekeepers or gardeners, but sometimes you want to hire help because it's something you don't enjoy doing or something you're not good at. That's when people reach out for the professional.
Okay, so we got the professionals here, you and Ray. So how again, does that person look and say, I plan to be here, and as long as I'm here, I want to maximize the utility. And help me with this one. In order to qualify for a federal annuity, do you have to work? Is it a minimum of 5 years?
For most purposes, it's a minimum of 5 years, yes. Although that requires you to hit the certain age requirements. If you only work 5 years, you're going to have to be 62 years old before you can collect the benefit. At different lengths of service, you essentially get to retire at earlier ages.
Okay, but if I was, let's say I'm new, a new youngish person, and I'm saying this annuity thing, pension thing, I'm going to have to work at least 5 years, but what if I leave federal service? Do I still qualify for an annuity 25 years from now?
You do, and that's actually a point that very few federal employees, I think, understand when they're young, that when they can work for a period of time, as long as it's at least 5 years, and then when they leave, at some point, depending on their age and the amount of service they had, they are going to be eligible to collect some federal benefit. It may not be the biggest benefit, but at least will be one of those components they have to spend in retirement.
Now,
and I think the other thing they don't understand as well is that their thrift savings plan completely belongs to them. The only thing in the TSP that has to be vested before it belongs to them is that automatic agency 1% contribution. So even a federal employee who might leave after a few years of service, it's definitely still worth it for them to start contributing to the TSP, even if federal service isn't their career, because that money will compound and grow over their lifetime, added to 401k money or other retirement savings they might have, and that's when it's going to really become something at the end of the game.
Okay, you bring up something I've always found of interest. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that you can add money to the thrift after you leave federal service, whether you leave federal service early. And it's just not any money, but it would be from a subsequent employer's retirement plan. Or if we join federal service late, we can bring in a retirement plan from a previous employer if they like the thrift better.
That's right.
As long as you don't cash out your account after you leave, and it still has a balance of money of at least $200 in it, they'll let you keep your TSP account going. And as you said, Bob, you can transfer money from other retirement accounts, whether it's an IRA, whether it's another company's retirement savings plan, and then take advantage of the low investment costs of managing it within the TSP.
And I probably speak more to pre-retirement classes, and you all cover the waterfront from beginning career all the way through pre-retirement. But when I tell them that in class, they just go, no. And I go, yeah, and here's the form. And so we have the form in the book, and we walk through why you might want to do it, or to be fair, why you might not want to do it. But like you say, Tammy, never shut it down. And for $200, you can certainly leave $200 in there and not feel it.
That's right.
Right. I think another plus to the TSP besides the low administrative expense is just the sheer simplicity of it. And I think for a lot of us who don't spend hours a week, managing our money, we're not old King Cole, so therefore we don't want to put a lot of time and effort into it. The TSP does make it very easy.
Okay, and one of the planning things that anyone should do, probably beginning early career, is to think about life insurance, and who better to explain that than the next person talking from WEPA.
The responsibilities of balancing a federal career and family life can be overwhelming. How can you assure your family will live well amidst life's transitions? WEPA, a nonprofit association serving the needs of federal civilian employees since 1943, in partnership with NITP, the national leader in federal benefits, financial literacy, and pre-retirement training, provides answers to your personal planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays, 10.05 a.m., for ideas that could change your future. WAPA members can now access frequently asked questions on key financial and retirement planning topics at waepa.org. Is your life on track? WAPA members also receive Fed checks, educational checklists for every stage of life and career. Visit WAPA today at waepa.org. WAPA is a proud sponsor of For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10.05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m.
Welcome back, and we're here talking about financial literacy with Ray Kirk, Dr. Ray Kirk, federal benefits specialist with NITP and former, I'll just cut it short, OPMer.
Right.
And Tammy Flanagan, co-host of the show and senior benefit director, NITP, GovExec columnist. And right before the break, we talked about somebody just entering federal service needs to be financially literate as to what they have. If they work 5 years, that could be a benefit far into the future. And I didn't ask this, and I'm not so sure of the answer. If you work the 5 years and then you decided to leave federal service, you can't come back. But if you never did come back, would you earn the rights to health insurance that you might want to tap into 25 years from then?
No, you don't. In order to be able to continue health insurance into retirement, you have to retire on an immediate annuity, meaning you leave federal service and then your annuity begins right away. So if you left after 5 years and had a 20-year gap, you wouldn't be eligible to continue it.
If I wanted to, though, and I could get back in and I felt like I could do some good, that I wasn't just trying to get health insurance, how long would I have to work if I came back in?
You wouldn't... Under the FERS retirement system, you could work a pretty short amount of time. It would be just a matter of months, actually. As long as you had that 5 years and you met the age requirement, you could technically require for an immediate and be eligible for an immediate annuity.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people get confused on the five-year coverage test where they think that you have to come back for 5 years. But like Ray said, as long as you had the health insurance prior to your separation, for 5 years, you could come back literally for one pay period, although, like Bob said, let's hope you're coming back for more than just the health insurance. Stay for a while and do some good, right?
Although I have had people ask me that who aren't currently working for the federal government, used to work for the government, they asked me exactly that question because their goal was to get back and get that insurance because they realized what a valuable benefit that is that most other employers aren't providing to their retirees.
And that's right at the heart of financial literacy. If you know that, and again, you do want to do some good, here you have this unparalleled benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Congress messes with it a little bit, even. We don't know
right.
that, though.
Okay. Yeah, along with health insurance, I think another advantage federal employees have who retire, and what Ray and I call it is an immediate retirement, where you're old enough when you separate, where you can collect your retirement next month. Along with health insurance, you also can continue your life insurance, your dental and vision supplements, and those are all things that help you afford to be retired because then you're not going out buying those on your own if you still have a need for it. But the one insurance benefit that doesn't require retirement to transfer is long-term care. And that you can just have it as a federal employee, even if you're not eligible to retire. You can keep that benefit for life, even if you're not vested with the 5 years.
Really? But,
yeah.
But somebody would have to have some federal experience to get the long-term care?
Just anyone who works for the government can enroll in the federal long-term care insurance, and if they resign the day after they enroll, it's lifetime coverage.
Okay.
Even if their parents sign up, or their in-laws, or their spouse, they can also keep it, even if the employee leaves.
What if they work part-time in the post office years ago? Could they get long-term care?
Well, it's only been around for how many years, Ray? Maybe 12 or 15?
Yeah, I think it's about 12 years. If the long ago was 12 years ago and you signed up while you have to sign up while you're an employee.
No.
Right.
But once you do that, as Tammy mentioned, it's a lifetime of continuation.
This question was self-serving. Let's call this the 60s.
I think, then you would just come back for a brief period of time and sign up for the insurance and then move on to something else.
All right. All right. Let's now come back. Let's take a look at the thrift. Again, financial literacy is our target today. And I go to the classes, you all do too, and somebody will say, I have $500,000 in my thrift. That's a lot of money. But is it enough to keep them accustomed to the lifestyle to which they want to remain? And I'm going to throw that out to you all.
Well, I think one of the first steps people have to do is think about what do they want to do in retirement, and then what is it going to take to support their goals? I mean, if they want to continue living, say, in the Washington, D.C. area, it's going to take a lot more monthly income than if they plan to move to Topeka, Kansas. So they have to think in those terms, even if they're not ready to make concrete decisions, and then start putting together the building blocks. They can get a retirement estimate, see how much they're going to get from FERS or how much they're going to get from SERS. One of the great things that TSP does, the Thrift Board, is the annual statements that you get, or you can go on their website and look up your account. They'll tell you what your current balance would get you in a monthly annuity. Not that you have to take your money that way, but it gives you an idea of how much that would contribute to your monthly cash flow. And then, of course, the third component for FERS people is the Social Security benefit. Tammy mentioned for some lower income people or lower grades in the government, could be a substantial piece of the retirement. And you can get a Social Security statement by going to socialsecurity.gov and signing up for the My Social Security account, and then get an estimate of what your Social Security benefit will be. And then put those three pieces together and see how close that comes to meeting what you think your spending needs will be.
Now, this is the epicenter of financial literacy, understanding the Social Security benefit. And fortunately, I've been around Tammy for a significant number of years and Ray more recently. I still don't understand it, but thank goodness I have the source. But there are things to understand other than qualify for it, right?
That's the first step, obviously, is to qualify. And I was just helping my cousin the other night. She was a housewife and raised her family and didn't really work much outside the home. But yet through the years, she pieced together 36 credits. And to qualify, you need 40 credits. So she's 4 credits short. So that's her incentive. Even though she's 68 years old, she says, I'm going back to work this year. And all she has to earn is $5,000. It'll give her the missing 4 credits. Now, considering that her time that she did pay into Social Security was just very small periods of low employment, but nonetheless, it's going to give her a benefit right now of $173 a month for the rest of her life. And if nothing else, it's going to pay for her Medicare premiums. So whether you've only had just a tiny bit of time under Social Security or whether you've had a whole lifetime, you want to get a feeling for how much that's going to provide as a replacement income. But then the second step is to also look at how much it's going to be whether you're 62 or whether you delay it till 66 or 70, because there's going to be a big difference between taking it early versus taking it later. And the real key to knowing the best time to take it is to know your end date. But since we don't, hopefully we don't know our end date, you're kind of gambling that if you take it later in life, you're going to live long enough to make it worth waiting. But if you take it at a younger age, you'll collect a smaller benefit, but for more years. And so it boils down to, do you need the money? Are you still working? And how long are you going to live? And I would add a fourth question to that as to who else is depending on your income. Because maybe while there's two of you, the situation will look different than when there's one of you. And that's something else to consider when it comes to claiming Social Security.
Okay. With the exception of the end date, all of those other pieces of information are on your Social Security statement. So it's a good idea. It's a good idea for people to go on the Social Security website, get that information, because it'll tell them how many quarters they have now or how many credits they have now. It'll tell them what their benefit would be at age 62, at their full retirement age, and when they're 70, as well as those benefits that some of their dependents might be eligible for.
And if you want to find the end date, they also have a life expectancy calculator on that. It'll tell you exactly how long you're going to live.
All right. Should I look at that?
I don't think so. No. Oh. It's getting close, Bob.
All righty.
For all of us.
Oh, boy. All righty. Tammy and Ray, you both brought up a term, quarters and credits. Quarters, if I may say, was the old way to look at qualifying for Social Security, and credit as I understand it now, you don't have to work particularly for a calendar quarter. You just have to make more than, like you were saying, Tammy, $5,000. Any time during the year, and you would get the whole year as a credit.
Exactly. Before 1978, that's when it changed over from quarters to credits. And back then, and some of us remember those days when you had to work from January to March, April to June, and so forth. In all those years prior to 1978, as long as you earned $50 in a calendar quarter, you were granted a quarter of coverage. But then the quarterly reporting ended, and now it's a copy of your W-2 form. So if you're employed by an employer like the federal government, your W-2 form goes to Social Security. They see how much you've earned. And for this year, it's, what is it, Ray, for every $1,120, you earn a credit of coverage. So if you earn $4,480, you've earned your four credits for the whole year. And you can do that in one day if you're lucky enough to make that much money in a day. But hopefully, for most of us, it takes longer than a day.
All right, good. Because to me, that was always a mystery, and I have a little bit better understanding of it, but you all have a command of it. So that's the Social Security side. Now we come back to the benefit side. Are we okay with talking about how somebody would qualify? And I think the high three, maybe we should explain how the high three works. Because I get in class and somebody says, I can work another month and get a higher high three. And I go, yes, you can, but it may not be the bonanza you think it is. What is it?
Well, it's the high three years average salary. And in some ways, I think it's easier to think of it as the highest 36 months continuous months, because it's a sliding 36-month window. So the example you gave, somebody who works 1 month longer, then they have a different 36 months, and it's going to bring in some the current one more month of their current salary and get rid of their salary 3 years ago. For 1 month's worth of it. So it's, but once you're in that final 36 months before you're ready to retire, then every day you work, typically your salary is going to get a little bit higher. Your average salary is going to get a little bit higher because you're pushing out a day at a lower salary and substituting a day of the higher salary. So getting a promotion 2 months before you retire, or getting a step increase 2 months before you retire, will increase your high three, but only on a prorated 2 months worth of it. So it's not the bonanza that you just mentioned.
Right. And the other thing people get confused about is when we say it's based on your basic pay. And I think people think when we say that, we're not including locality pay. But actually, your locality pay is part of your basic pay. So if you work in the Washington, D.C. area, it's that Washington, D.C. pay chart that's used for your high three average. But it's not going to be your bonus or cash award or annual leave, lump sum payment. Those things are not part of your basic pay, and they would not help your high three.
Okay. So let's move into the thrift.
Before we do that, Bob, why don't we finish that? Because we talked about high three, but you don't get your high three as your retirement. You're going to get a portion of it. And Ray could probably explain a little bit more about how important it is to know your length of service and what can affect your length of service when we're computing that.
Yeah, your length of service, and the jargon that in the retirement world they use is your service computation date, which is a date used to then calculate from that starting date to the date of your retirement how long your service period was. And while it's for most people going to cover the time they're actually working as a civilian, there are other things that they can make deposits for, such as if they were in the military, they can make a deposit. Their deposit means that they pay to the civilian retirement system the retirement contributions. If they do that, then they're eligible to add that military service onto the civilian service and increase the length of time used in retirement. Or some other types of service, like if you're a Peace Corps volunteer, you could add on to that civilian service.
Mm-hmm. And for the FERS employees, it's a very simple calculation. Once you understand your length of service and your high three salary, then you just multiply both of those by 1%, or in some cases 1.1%, and then you're going to have a good idea of how much income that FERS retirement is going to provide. So, for instance, if your high three average salary was $60,000 and you had 30 years of service, so 30% of $60,000 would give you $18,000 a year. So that's your base. That's what's going to come in every year for the rest of your life. Plus, on top of that, you've paid into Social Security probably since you were 16 or 15, so you have your Social Security benefit, which might add another $18,000, maybe more. And then you can figure out how much you need from the TSP, because those two things are going to be set for life. Your TSP is probably the most flexible part of your retirement plan.
Okay, could I ask you all a question? I'm going to pretend I'm a retired military, or I've left the military, and I want to go to work as a civil servant. Can I deposit my military buyback, if you will, when I first join the civilian side, or do I have to wait till later on? This is a two-pronged question.
Right. You can make the military deposit at any time once you become a civilian. And there is but interest, if you delay, interest accrues. So you're better off typically to make it early. And there's a 2-year window where there is no interest. So if you do make a deposit within the first 2 years of joining federal service, then you would just pay the amount that's calculated on your military base pay. So the military base pay is assumed to be what your salary was. Then you pay a contribution based on that. If you delay beyond that 2-year interest-free window, then there's a variable interest rate that accrues every year. So the interest gets bigger and bigger. So if you waited till just before you retired, you'd owe a much larger military deposit than if you had done it early.
That's where I was going. All right. Now, when I use the term float. That means goes up and down like we just heard. Currently, is the interest rate pegged to any particular rate? Is it the prime?
Oh, yeah,
it's the G fund?
The Treasury rate of return. It's the same rate of return that's used for the G fund and the Civil Service Trust Fund. The difference is this interest rate only changes once a year. So we know that for 2015, the entire year, the interest rate is, I think it's 2% now, isn't it, Ray?
Yes, it is. That's right.
The 2% interest rate. So that won't change again until January of next year. So when you pay back a military deposit, it's usually a composite rate because you have your anniversary date, which is when the interest accrues for you every year. So you'll have a little bit of this year's interest, a little bit of next year's interest. And then if you pay it off before your next anniversary of federal service, you don't have to pay any more interest. So your interest is compounding every single year.
So
as long as you pay it back before your next federal service anniversary, you don't have to pay that year's interest.
So my financial literacy tutelage I just heard is if I'm going to pay it back, I have to pay X dollars. If I don't pay it back right now, it isn't that I can't later, but if I'm paying 2% on it to borrow money, you can't borrow money at 2%. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to invest it and earn more than 2%, you might look to delay it. I didn't say till forever, but until the next interest rate comes on. Would that make sense?
Yeah, it just depends on how well you manage money and how conservatively you invest. If you're just going to stick the money in a bank account earning 0.002%, then you may as well pay it off to avoid the interest.
Right.
But if you're good at managing money, you want to invest in a different type of investment vehicle while you're deciding what to do, you really do have, like Ray said, up until the day you retire to pay these off. So I always tell people the most important thing is it doesn't cost you a dime to find out how much you owe. So talk to your human resources office. Find out, number one, do you have service that might be subject to a deposit? Because some employees don't realize they owe money until they're ready to retire. So find out if you have any type of service that might be covered by a deposit, whether it's military or civilian. And then the second question is, how much do I have to pay? And maybe the third and most important question is, what happens if I don't pay it? You know, how will that affect my retirement, whether I pay this back or I don't? Because sometimes finding out how much you owe can be very shocking to some people. Oh, my goodness, I owe this much money. But when you tell them this is how it's going to impact your retirement, then they see the light as to why it's important to consider paying back.
Right.
Or not, you know, depending on how they feel about that.
Right. One comment I'd like to make about when you get that amount of money that Tammy just mentioned, it could be a shocking amount. You don't have to pay it all in one time. It's not like you have to sit and write a check for whatever that amount is.
Right.
You can come up with a payment schedule, and you determine the payment schedule. So you could say, I'm going to pay $200 this year, and next year hopefully I'll be in better situation. I can pay a couple thousand. But whatever, you determine how much you're going to pay, at what schedule you're going to pay it. So there's a lot of flexibility.
Right. Whether it's civilian service deposit, we're talking about, or military, the military deposits you can do as a payroll deduction. If it's civilian service, you can pay it directly to OPM, and as Ray said, you can pay it whenever you have the money. Just write a check now and then. I think it only has to be in multiples of $25, correct, Ray?
Yes, and one of the things I suggest to people in class is that as a strategy they might consider, if they get a tax refund, turn that into a payment on a deposit that they owe and use that as their savings device.
Good, and the final comment, and then we're going to take a break. Whatever they pay, both in principal and interest, would become a tax deduction, not when they pay it, but it would be spread out over the life expectancy of the annuity. So it isn't just money that's spent. You get a small tax deduction each year. With that, I think it's time to take a break and listen to the good folks at WAPA.
The responsibilities of balancing a federal career and family life can be overwhelming. How can you assure your family will live well amidst life's transitions? WAPA, a nonprofit association serving the needs of federal civilian employees since 1943, in partnership with NITP, the national leader in federal benefits, financial literacy, and pre-retirement training, provides answers to your personal planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays, 10:05 a.m., for ideas that could change your future. WAPA members can now access frequently asked questions on key financial and retirement planning topics at waepa.org. Is your life on track? WAPA members also receive Fed checks, educational checklists for every stage of life and career. Visit WAPA today at waepa.org. WAPA is a proud sponsor of For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m.
Welcome back to Ray Kirk, Federal Benefits Specialist with NITP, former manager at OPM. Tammy Flanagan, WXEC columnist, co-host of the show, and seminar presenter. Alrighty, so we're back, and we just left, and Ray said, you know, well, you said tax deduction. You might want to be more clear with that right before the break. When anybody retires, FERS, CSRS, offset, etc., their annuity is not fully subject to tax, and it's based on money that they were involuntarily had it withheld throughout their career, and that's a tax deduction when they retire. It's small, but it's a tax deduction. This would become part of that, so you're not going to get a tax deduction for the whole amount when you pay it. It's going to be spread out over this life expectancy when you retire. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, we're talking about federal level, because in some states, like where I've moved to in Florida, there is no state income tax, so that's a nice benefit for people who have large federal pensions where it's not taxable on the state level, but that's only in some states.
Yeah, good point. Around here, not everybody is inside the Beltway that's listening to the show, but you might be in your own area, whether it's Chicago, L.A., Denver. Around here, Pennsylvania is not real far away. It sounds like it's far away, but it's an interesting state tax-wise. They don't tax the federal annuity, and they don't tax the thrift. So you find pockets of people going up. There's this road called 270, and it goes to an area called Gettysburg, which I think anybody recognizes, and it's a huge population boom of feds. And then on the other side of the Beltway, going up the Beltway in York, Pennsylvania, same thing. Now, I don't think anybody should move for tax reasons, but certainly it's one of the top five.
Yeah, Pennsylvania is. I've heard it's the second most popular state for retirees, believe it or not.
Yeah. Got to watch your real estate taxes there. Somewhat
and
like
the
Florida.
Weather.
Yeah, and the weather. Yeah, the weather. Tammy's got a corner on the weather now. All right.
Yeah, well,
so do we go to the thrift now?
Sure.
Okay, so I've got X dollars in there, and I'm feeling, you know, pretty good that I've got, you know, a couple hundred thousand, 300,000, and it sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but in the grander scheme of things, is it enough to take care of us for that gap we might have between expenses and income, personal expenses and retirement and income? The thrift should be a part of that plan to pay it. So when is enough? And I don't know the answer. If I had the answer to that, I think I wouldn't be on the radio. But the answer lies with everybody's going to be different. But how do you all approach it?
I would say one thing with that is that you look at your what we just talked about, your Social Security income, your federal retirement income, whether it be from CSRS or FERS. And for many federal retirees who have spent a career in federal service, and Ray could probably attest to this because he's one of them, that benefit could cover your living expenses. So you're not necessarily going to need monthly income stream from the TFP for everybody. So that's the first thing you have to determine. Do you need a monthly income stream from your thrift to pay your bills, to live, to pay your groceries, your insurance, your rent, your mortgage, whatever you're paying, and then decide how much else you might need. And I saw a really cool calculator on Schwab's, I'll give them credit, Schwab's investment site. And they said, if you, let's say you need $25,000 a year, that's what you need to add to your Social Security income and your FERS income, you still need another $25,000. If you take that and multiply it by 25, take whatever you need per year, multiply it by 25, that's going to give you some idea of how much you better have in the bank to produce $25,000 a year income. So if I multiply $25,000 times 25, I come up with $625,000, which is basically saying if I've got $625,000 in my TSP, I should realistically be able to withdraw $25,000 a year as long as it's invested. It's not just all sitting there under my mattress, that it could last me, you know, a pretty good long time, hopefully the rest of my life. So that would be one rule of thumb. I don't know that that's going to work for everybody and everybody's investment style, but that would be just a little picture, a little snapshot of how you might look at that.
Tammy, does that $25,000 that you put in, do they bake into that a COLA so that today's $25,000 withdrawal would be tomorrow's $26,000 withdrawal?
Right. That's allowing for inflation. That's also allowing for the balance to continue to be invested. And I think the investment rate they used was about a 6% return. So that's not too outlandish, but it's more than keeping your money in the bank or the G fund.
Okay, good. And like you say, Tammy, you looked at the Schwab when you went to their Wikipedia, the websites that they had. I mean, they were almost mind-numbing. The AICPA, the American Institute of CPAs, has got one, but it's just got so many calculators on it. So you have to know what you're looking at before you go into those things.
But I think Tammy's made a good point that the simple is better when you're just starting out and making a plan, that as you get more sophisticated, maybe you get closer to retirement and you can refine your estimates a little more. You can start doing use other more complicated projections like Bob just referred to. They have lots of variables. But early in your career, just to get a target amount, you should simple is better than complicated.
And I tell new employees also, like, don't even, I mean, it's impossible to figure out, you know, what's going to happen to your money between now and then, but come up with a strategy. You know, I'm going to save, you know, start with 5% of my pay, and every time I get a pay raise, I'm going to increase it by one-third of that pay raise. And if you use that strategy, I guarantee you, by the time you're eligible to retire, you should be in pretty good shape. So just come up with a plan. You know, have a strategy, stick to it. Don't come out of the market whenever it falls, and don't go into the market when it's at its highest. Just, you know, have a plan and kind of stay with it. Slow and steady will sometimes win the race.
Yeah.
And that is one of the advantages of programs like the TSP, where it's an automatic salary deduction that's coming out every pay period. You're making that same. So you selected you're going to contribute 5%. That's going to be a level contribution rate. And so as the market fluctuates, you're going to be staying in there and taking advantage of when stocks are low in price and not selling off when they get the market turns against you.
Yeah, you just gave a description of a very important financial literacy term, which is dollar cost averaging. And that's what federal employees do every 2 weeks when they invest in the TSP.
What's that mean? They invest low and they invest high, but
they buy every 2 weeks consistently. So they're buying when the market's high, they're buying when the market's low. But when it's high, their balance is earning money. When it's low, they're buying in at low rates of return. But they're doing it consistently over long periods of time. And if they're not sure, should I be putting it in the C or the G or the F or the S or the I fund? That's why they invented the life cycle fund. So it does give you a nice balanced investment based on your time horizon, because there's five different life cycle funds to choose from based on how far you are from needing the money.
It's a great point, because people say, well, I'm going to buy when the market bottoms and sell when. Well, the people that do that are very few.
Well, you got to know where's the bottom and where's the top.
Right. Right. There are very few of them. And so the idea.
Yeah, we could say we're at the top now, but it could go up another 2 years, or it could fall tomorrow. You know, nobody knows.
That's true. But here it's automatically done for you.
So, yep.
Right, and a point Tammy made about the life cycle funds is rather than you coming up with your own individual investment strategy, which if you're willing to devote the time to it, you certainly might come up with a really good one. But the life cycle funds have a professionally developed investment model that shifts over time as you get closer to the time you need the money. And you go on the TSP website and they'll show you just how the model is, what it's going to, how aggressive or how, whether it's going to be going after like the C fund and the S fund and the I fund while you're younger or further away from your target date. But as you get closer to the target date, the investments shift to be a little more conservative, to be less, so there's less, you're less subject to the ups and downs of the market.
Right.
Well, we've got two emails. One email says, why isn't financial literacy taught in high school?
It is now in some high schools, but not across the country. And I agree. That would be a wonderful course for our kids. I wish we would have learned it, because I could have used it back in high school.
And me too. Mine was spend,
mm-hmm.
Right. Believe it or not.
That was mine too. Save for retirement. My goodness, that's so far away.
All righty, and here's the second one. I've always been told that CSRS Offset is the best of the three retirement plans, but preliminary estimates from personnel show it much below a straight CSRS annuity.
Because they're leaving out one part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Ray and I both agree CSRS Offset, if you can get into it, which is not something you can choose. But if you're in it, we call it the best of both worlds, because your civil service benefit is at the very least going to be exactly what it would have been had you been pure civil service. But when you qualify for Social Security, OPM will reduce or offset your civil service benefit. But if you apply for your Social Security retirement at the same time you're subject to the offset, you're going to make up what you just lost, and in every case I've seen, you get more because you have more Social Security throughout your lifetime than just those years you spent under offset. And the formula is really to the favor of the retiree. So when you add the Social Security to the civil service offset together, you're usually going to have a higher total income than if you had just been rehired as pure civil service.
All righty. The final part of the question that the questioner sent in, I think you just hit on it, but it says, how can I get help to get these calculations right? The online calculators don't seem to work for the offset crowd. Help, yeah. And thanks.
That's right.
Well, I think the first step would be to contact their agency HR office and find out what their internal process is for getting a detailed retirement estimate. The emailer is right that a lot of the online calculators that are available, the quick and dirty ones, don't take into consideration all of the ins and outs that Tammy mentioned about the offset. But if you work with your agency HR office, they can tell you what their process, because it varies by agency, but they can do a detailed estimate, and that will incorporate the information about the offset.
Yeah. And help You'll usually have to provide them with your Social Security earnings record, which you can get from the Social Security website.
Right, because the agencies aren't going to have access to that. But given you provide that, the calculators they have available are much more detailed and can do the calculation and give you a pretty accurate estimate.
That's right.
All righty. We have about 4 minutes left in the show, so why don't we bring this close to the finish line and say, okay, we've talked about beginning career, somewhat mid-career, and now we're late pre-retirement, or we're actually in retirement. And let's say we're in retirement and we maybe didn't pay as much attention to what we've just talked about. What can somebody adjust at that point? Their annuity's kind of set. The thrift, they can take more out of the thrift early on, but it might dry up the thrift earlier on. So what does somebody do?
Well, if they're late career and they haven't retired yet and they realize, oh my goodness, you know, I don't have as much money as I thought I did, well, one or two more years of service can do wonders both to your TSP account and to bump up the value of your basic retirement benefit. So I think you really have to target, you know, when is the best time for you to retire based financially as well as mentally and emotionally. But if you're already in retirement, then you may have some other issues.
But even if you're in retirement, then you have to assess what are you spending your money on. It's always, as throughout your life, it's kind of the needs versus the wants. And if you're in retirement and you're finding that everything you want to do isn't affordable by based on your income, you need to look at those things that you are spending money on and see if you can make adjustments. Or you could go and look for another source of income. You could get a part-time job. You could move to a different area. You could, like Tammy did, move to a lower tax state.
Right.
But you need to assess your financial situation and what you are actually spending money on and how much of those expenses you actually need to have.
And I think the other thing worth mentioning is that I talk to a lot of people who want help, professional help in getting to that goal to see where am I? Am I on track? Am I not? But they're afraid to hire a financial advisor because, you know, we hear all the horror stories of being taken advantage of. So I think the other financial literacy term we need to emphasize today would be the word fiduciary. And the TSP is a good example of that because they have a fiduciary responsibility to look out for your best interest rather than their own. And if you're going to hire a financial planner to help you, that would be a question to ask them. Are you my fiduciary? Are you going to look out for my best interest? Or are you just selling me a product to make a commission?
Okay, we have 35 seconds left. Final comments, Ray?
Well, I think people need to, as we emphasize in the show, get started early. And don't be afraid when you see maybe some big numbers, but just start chipping away at your financial goals.
Very good. Thanks for being here. Tammy, final comment?
Just don't wait too long to retire because the little glimpses I'm having of it, it's a lot of fun.
Oh, my goodness. That was aimed at me. Thanks for listening. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.